Okay, now we're rocking and rolling here. Some of us are rocking and rolling a little too much with weird smoke, and other people have hurricanes.
Oh, my goodness. I know.
Fire.
I know. I feel so bad for everybody. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
our daughter lives in the Bay Area, and so, and you know, lots of friends out there. So
you've been yeah. looking at our red phone, red landscape post. Right.
I have. It's just unbelievable. It really is. It's just, oh my goodness.
I guess we're going to be creating more memoirs this way, huh?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So let me introduce you. Let me introduce you, and if I leave, I'll do a short one, and then you add anything that you like to this. So, again, Linda Joy Myers here with Gretchen Sherrington for our virtual book club for September 2020, the year of the apocalypse. Gretchen is the author of Poetic License, and it's published through She Writes Press in 2020, just a few weeks ago. And this book, I'll have you tell us more, Gretchen, but it's about her complex relationship with her father, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Richard Eberhart. And Gretchen has had her essays published in many places and has had some excerpts published in Literary Hub and the Nerd Daily. And one of her essays was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
I can see why you're a beautiful writer. And so Gretchen is here with us today. Anything else you want to add to that bio, Gretchen?
No, that's a good way to start.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I was pleased to be able to read your book, you know, when you were still finishing up everything, and found it just unable to put it down. And the one reason is the story was fascinating. Another was your writing is so beautiful. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I learned everything from you and Brooke.
Well, well, you brought your own package of talent with you, I think, here. So I thought we'd start with first you talking about, you know, the arc of writing this book. I think you touched on it in posts I've read, but I don't remember the details. So when did you start writing it? What made you want to write it? And we'll talk about that journey some more.
Yeah, great. Thank you. First of all, thank you so much, Linda Joy, for making this opportunity possible for me. And I'm delighted to have a lot of people on the phone and frankly, kind of a nice break from Zoom. So thank you for that. I started writing this book actually just about 20 years ago. So I was in my late 40s, and I was beginning to come to terms with what I saw as kind of a different view of my father that I had than what I thought his public had. And that conflict, if you will, grew kind of in me emotionally, and it was pretty hard for me to figure out how to kind of tell a coherent story about my father. And I was probably a little bit desperate. It felt a little bit like an existential crisis that I was dealing with. I just felt like I had to do something. And so I turned to really just jotting down little snippets of memories and trying to remember, you know, things that had happened. And I, you know, from there I started taking some writing workshops locally here in New Hampshire got it to a pretty good place, I thought, you know, within the first 8 years or so, and got an agent and then another one, and neither was able to sell the book to the traditional publishing houses nor to university presses. University presses were a little afraid of touching it. And the traditional presses, I think, didn't think they could sell enough copies. And truthfully, the book was a lot worse than it is now. So I'm frankly kind of grateful at this point that it didn't come out back then. But, you know, so that set me back for a while. Meanwhile, of course, I'm running this consulting company and I've got kids growing up a new marriage and things happening, and so it's not like I was doing this full time.
Right.
But I was working on it for quite a while, and then it was really 2 years ago, I think, after I retired from consulting, that I, you know, thought about the book, and the only question I could think of was, well, if not now, when? You know, so I wasn't getting any younger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through a confluence of things, I was introduced to Brooke, and, you know, the rest is history. The book was completely rewritten during the six-month Write Your Memoir class that you and she taught. I learned mm-hmm. so much from, and really, over the that was about 6 months, but it took me about a year to really complete rewriting mm-hmm. the whole thing. And, yeah, so it's been a long journey.
Well, I think, thank you for sharing all that because, there are so many people on the line, some of whom I know pretty well, some of whom I've, you know, seen at some other of our programs. And, you know, pretty much everybody's problem, if we want to phrase it that way, is, oh, my God, this is taking too long. Or does everyone take this long? Or why does it have to take this long?
For sure. Yeah. I think it's pretty hard to, obviously memoirists write books in a year or 2 years or something. But I never had any official training in writing aside from, you know, high school, basically. And even though I grew up around a lot of famous writers and knew how important it was and sort of respected it as a craft and art form, I really had to learn how to be a creative writer. And I think I was also very steeped in business writing at the time, you know, business reports and slide decks and, you know, cut and dry kind of stuff, not much emotion in it. And so I had to unlearn that, and that took a while. And I guess, you know, in some ways I'm kind of grateful it took this long. It's easy to say now that it's over, I guess, but I am, because my perspective has changed some, and obviously, you know, you grow in experience and you evolve as a human being, and so I think it's a much better book now than it would have been, you know, even 10 years ago.
Well, let's stick with that subject for a second, because I think that's so important. I know that was true for me. It took me off and on, a lot of off, 15 years or so, and I wasn't going to write a book. I wasn't planning to write a book. I was just trying to, in fact, I was going to write a novel about our life. That's before memoir was a thing. You know, nobody wrote memoirs but famous people. It was that long ago.
Right.
And, you know, and then lots of people that I work with or teach or you know, our coach here on NAMW, then there's the whole issue of the broken parts and the healing and the therapy, you know.
Yes.
Sometimes,
yes.
Favorite, right?
Absolutely. And, I mean, I could not have gotten to where I am now without a lot of therapy. And I, you know, I had kind of two challenges. One was just learning how to write and figure out what the story really was and figure out who I was and who my father was and how we related. But the second mm-hmm. challenge was that he had a public, you know, he was a public figure. And so, and certainly when I started this, I mean, his career was kind of moving into the late phase, let's say, because he lived to be 101, and I was sort of started when he was about 90 or so is when I started, and so I think the track of me trying to figure out how to say things in public about a person that has a public persona was super challenging, and that took me a really long time to get my head around. And frankly, I don't know that I could have gotten this or would have really gotten this book published by my own choice before he died, even though I did try at one point. as I look back on it now, I think that was the right choice for me. People mm-hmm. make all kinds of choices about these things when they're writing yeah. a memoir, but I think that was the right one for me. And
well, then there's your voice.
Yeah.
I mean, he had his voice, and his voice was very
yes.
much his voice, and many people were in awe of that voice and all the awards and the fame and everything. And so here you are.
Mm-hmm.
You get to have a voice? Do I get to have a voice? Did you ever have any interesting arguments with yourself about that?
Oh, my God, yes. I loved the whole inner critic talk that you gave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and I still do, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely, I mean, the inner critic in me was about, well, I'll just give you a little story that when I was in my mm-hmm. early 20s, I think, I happened to go to a dinner at my parents' house, and it was a time when I really had no interest in writing, except that I had a journal, you know, I did journal, and so I probably had some really fleeting fantasy about it, but it was fleeting at best. And I looked around the room, the living room, and pretty much everybody there had a Pulitzer Prize.
Yay!
And so that was my standard, you know, that was my standard. And I just, you know, cowered in the idea of going in that direction. And so that was a big piece of it, I think, that, you know, I didn't feel like I was good enough. I didn't feel like I had a right to my story. I didn't feel like I had a right to my voice or voicing my opinion back in those days. And it took me a long time to find that voice and to feel confident enough to use it. And some of that came through my career, really. We'll get into that maybe later. But,
okay.
Yeah, inner critics for sure. And I still do. I think probably some on this call may know that I was really lucky to get a review in the New York Times and really unlucky to get a really bad review in the New York Times.
Oh, that was something. Wow.
And I felt really shamed by that. You know, I felt kind of re-triggered by that. It was, once again, I felt like, no, I don't belong, obviously. You know, I don't have a right to you know, be part
of the club. Be in that club.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly. And so mm-hmm. that, you know, I think this inner critic stuff is not something that you shed lightly.
Well, and do we ever completely shed it? I mean, that's not something I think most of us can actually do.
Right.
I'm going to come back to that review in a little bit. Okay, so just park that for
yep.
a second. I want to ask you, so one of the, because we're sort of on this point of talking about truth to power and, you know, both, I think, in terms of being writers, but also what we do in our lives. And for a lot of people, the memoir is the testimony, you know, of
mm-hmm.
experience. And we often are writing it, I think, either in dread or hope or both of someone reading it that we know.
Yep.
So can you talk about that a little bit more, please?
So I might have missed the last part. We are writing in dread or hope.
Of someone in the family or someone we know. I mean, we have these audiences
yes.
in our head, and
yes.
we may wish that someone would read it and see our point of view, or we may dread what we think they're going to
yes.
think or say.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you certainly and Brooke, you know, spoke very well to that in the sense of, you know, not showing your work, being careful not to show your work until you're really ready to show it, until frankly it's just about done and maybe you have a contract, because before that, if you get negative feedback from family members, it really throws you off. It's hard to do with that. And I did have a little bit of that experience early in this 20-year phase, maybe it was 10 years out or something, and with one family member who you know, read it and didn't, I mean, it wasn't like anything really nasty, but it was pretty clear that this person had quite a different experience than me and didn't really appreciate me, you know. There was no big support anyway. And now in the end that person came around and I was very grateful for it. I think one of the things that I feel now that I did well was in this regard was that I did keep my husband obviously and my two adult children kind of up to speed with what I was doing. And I shared an early draft with all of them, and then I didn't share anything with the kids until it was really just about done. But I had talked about the issues and the story of their grandfather and enough. They knew what had happened to me, and so that was not a surprise. And I think that, you know, sort of bringing them along with me in the process without overdoing that somehow worked well, I think, in retrospect. And, you know, one thing that was very gratifying to me was that, you know, here I have spent 20 years trying to figure out who my father is. And when my two children read, you know, they're adults, but when my children read the book just before it went to production, I mean, time enough for them to give me some feedback to change things, but right at the end there, you know, I asked them if they had any surprises, you know, when they read it, and they said, no, not a single one. So I felt grateful for that, you know, that somehow they had sort of come along with me, and there was no surprise, and they weren't going to have to spend 20 years of their life figuring me out. But I think the whole family issue is fascinating. One thing that has surprised me since the book has come out in this arena is that these aren't so much family members. Well, a little bit, you know, a couple cousins and some, you know, old friends who've known me for most of my life. They knew my story. It was not a shocking piece of news. But reading the book was really hard for them. You know, it's pretty visceral. And that was a surprise to me, Linda Joy, because I think, you know, I've been living with this for 50 years, I've got it down, you know, and so just talking with these folks who are kind of struggling with their own experiences of my parents and now what they think of them and all of that, I mean, that I wasn't quite thinking, I mean, I hadn't thought about that, so word to the wise out there, you know, what are we thinking about? And you probably have lots of ideas about that.
Well, I mean, you just never know what people are going to think, and you can guess wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
And you can think, oh, that's no big deal, and to somebody else it's huge. I mean, it's weird. And then we have adjusted ourselves to our own story. So, like, there were times when I would read aloud either early on when I was working on this in my master's program or later, you know, when I was sharing parts of the story about my mother and grandmother and some of the conflicts, and people would, you know, go, whoa, I mean, how did you live through that?
Right.
I'm like, oh, that was nothing. I mean, I left out most
of
it.
right. Yeah, it's so fascinating, right? The whole process is just quite amazing. I mean, thankfully, I've had really mostly just totally positive experience. I do think the whole family issue is one to take seriously.
Well, you know, and we talked in class, and let's address this for a second for the listeners, and that is, you know, everybody has to decide how they are going to prepare the people in the book for a book once it's time to be published. So some people are going to inform people, some people are going to do permission asking and have them read it and sign off on it.
Uh-huh.
And some people aren't going to be, maybe they'll be tempted to say nothing, but I, as a family therapist, think that's a little fraught, but it's not up to me to tell people what to do, in that it can be maybe a good way or maybe it'll backfire, you know,
uh-huh.
So there's just different ways to handle that. And So you did let people know, and you took that on and went through that process, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. I did. And in the end, I was glad that I had sort of done it that way. And, I mean, with the exception of my ex-husband, for instance, who I talk about a little bit in the book, I hadn't told him anything, and I was pleasantly surprised by his response. You know, I told him I would change his name. I told him if he had anything, you know, really seriously, I didn't give him too many options, but I gave him a little bit of leeway to give me some feedback. And I really had no idea what to expect from him, and I was grateful for quite a generous response, really, that no, he didn't need his name changed, and you know, it reminded him of a lot of good things and bad things, and they were all important. So I felt very lucky about that one.
Well, he's a pretty good guy in the book, too. I mean, you know, so, basically. And then the people in our lives whom were, you know, 50 years ago, well, you know, things change.
Right.
But then, you know, I think with people that we may have spent time with when we were very young, it reminds them of an era that is gone with whom we might be one of the only or few people they share that time of their own life with, so that, you know, you have that bond no matter what happened, you know.
Right, right. That's so true.
Yeah. Well, good. Yeah. I'm glad. So now you in the points that we said we would cover, this is an interesting one. And so apparently there were a few tips and techniques you didn't use in your first memoir that you will use in your second, and I have no idea what you're going to
do. Okay. Well, let's see. One of them is an outline. I never had an outline. The other one is your turning points thing, where you help us figure out what the turning points in our life were. That was really good, and I wished I had done that, you know, decades ago. But the structure, outline, some kind of outline, and looking at the turning points. I mean, I thought those were really good craft techniques that I had not, even in a lot of other workshops, had not really been taught before. And this next book that I'm working on, I will definitely use them, because I think that although I'm more on the free flow side than the totally structured side, I think, of life, I do appreciate some structure, and I do think that it would save time, you know, if I had some structure. Those are the three that I think specifically I was talking about.
Well, I can
sign
on for those. Yeah, I was one of those right-brain writers, too, and realized that I just got myself lost and tangled up in multiple layers of nets and webbing.
Right.
Confusion. And, I mean, also if you're thinking about layers of time, and then it's like, well, where do you position yourself? You know,
you have to find
a place where...
Yeah.
Where did you position yourself as the narrator, Gretchen?
Well, I think I tried to ground myself in the 1990s, in that decade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from there, I kind of flashed back to early life, and then once we got to the 90s, I went forward. You know, so it is more or less a chronological, I mean, it's a whatever, is that how you define
yes.
it, a chronological memoir? But it is grounded in the 1990s, and one of the challenges of this book is that my, you know, this takes us through a long period of time, and that's not that common in memoir. I mean, I think a lot of memoirs are about 1 year or 1 week or 6 years or something. And so
not mine.
Not yours.
I can relate.
That's right. I mean, there are some, but I think it's a little bit less common, and it's challenging because one of my purposes was that I wanted to show the lifelong effect of sexual abuse, molestation on someone, and that it's not just a one-time thing or a, you know, two-year thing, that it has ripple effects through your lifetime. So that was one of the things that I kind of wanted to convey. And then, you know, there was also the issue of my father living so long. And so I think, you know, that was particularly challenging to sort of figure out how to compress into whatever it is, 300 pages-ish, you know, that whole sort of arc of existence. And hopefully I did it okay. But it was really grounded in the 1990s. That's when I was doing the research on him in his literary archives at Dartmouth. That's when I was overcoming a divorce and getting into a new relationship. That's when my career was taking off. That was a very rich decade, rich both, you know, negatively and positively. And so that was kind of my touch point. And one of the devices I used, I don't know if she's on this call tonight, but one of the devices I used was my friend Ellen, with whom I would, you know, get together for a glass of wine to sort of figure out what the hell I just read about in his archives. And that was during the 90s, at least in this book it is. It's slightly retimed from reality, but to work with a story. So hopefully that answers that question.
Yeah. Well, it's a very complex book, and I was like, oh, my God, how did she keep all that stuff organized figure it out. Many passes, many edits, right?
Many, many edits. In fact, I'll tell a little secret to the, well, it won't be a secret anymore, but I suppose with any publisher, but with She Writes Press, they call, when they first send you the designed pages of your books after the designer has done the inside look of the book,
right.
It's called like first pages. And so then you respond with your corrections. Well, I went through 11 corrections.
Yeah.
I had my first set of corrections was 45 pages long, and I think Shannon almost, you know, kicked me out of the club. but basically, you know, all that to say that I was really editing it right up to the last second. And if I pick it up now because I'm doing a reading or something, why did I say it that way? I should have said it this way.
Oh,
hey,
I'm, do you edit when you read? I got to where I would edit when I read.
I do edit when I read. Yeah, I do, and I hope nobody notices, but...
No, you're the one who knows, but it's so funny because, you know, to the perfectionists on the line,
exactly.
One or two listening in, and you know,
that's
you
right.
Always can see stuff later. But you know, there's a time when you release, and it helps to have a publisher saying, "This is it. Today is it. That's it."
It does. Yeah, it really does. I was, you know, I was very keen on not having any errors in it and typos and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard from anybody that I do, so I hope that's true. But I was very eager to really make it as clean as possible, and of course now I would redo it all probably. But,
yeah, well, you can do that on a second book. So you are writing a second book?
I am, yes. I started it a while ago, and I'm going to pick it up again hopefully later this fall and get going on it. It's slated to come out in, I think, spring of 22, which sounds very soon. So I don't know if I'll make that, but it's that you've been introduced to the piece of it. You've been introduced to sort of the core of it in Poetic License. It will be a story about three. It'll be, I think, I'm calling it memoir. I don't know how it will be structured yet. And Brooke Warner isn't totally sure if it's memoir, but I think it will be. But anyway, it involves three men with big ideas who converge on the banks of the Red Cedar River in southern Minnesota in 1900. One of them is George A. Hormel, the founder of what is now Hormel Foods, and one is my grandfather, who was the executive vice president and helped build the company through the first 20 years. And one is the embezzler, who is an employee at the company. And the book is called Too Big to Fail. It is a story that I think resonates with what we went through in the Great Recession, unquote, quote unquote, because this company was brought to its knees and was bailed out by the banks because they were worried that there'd be a Great Depression, you know, really in southern Minnesota. There were so many employees that worked there. And the reason I'm interested in it is, one, it's a fascinating story, and two, with my consulting background, I'm, you know, that's where the memoir comes in a little bit, sort of me as a granddaughter, but also as a professional looking at companies and what happens and why they do what they do and how it affects people. And my father kept all of his stuff, but he also kept all of his father's stuff. So I have great records of what happened. So I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a fun book, well, you know, much more fun than Poetic License to write, and not nearly as
emotionally
fraught.
Well, you get to have guilty parties that aren't you, you know?
Exactly, that's right.
Not that you should be guilty of anything, I'm not saying that, but, you know, the whole thing about memoirs exposing yourself.
Yeah, I know. Plenty guilty, yep, yeah. So anyway, that's
fascinating, like a historical fiction memoir. I mean, not fiction, but historical, where you're going to be, it sounds,
something about that, something.
Well, complicated, but very, very interesting, Good, well, okay, so the other thing is you had, you know, want to find out if you were in a writing group along the way, and how you found or used your beta readers, and how you found or used editors.
Sure.
We'll talk a little bit about that part of writing and publishing.
Right. So in the early days, when I was taking these local workshops on writing, you know, it was a sort of anonymous, I mean, it was just a random group of people getting together, and, you know, some of us got to know each other over time, and from that came what was really my first writing group. And I think there were six of us, maybe. And we kind of hung together for, you know, none of us had been published in book form. Some of us had been published in, you know, magazines or whatever. And we hung together for maybe 5 or 6 years or so, and it was just so tremendously helpful to have them. We often just wrote together. You know, we also critiqued each other's work, but sometimes we just liked writing in the same place together. There was that energy, you know, that was great. And we a couple times went off on a retreat, you know, for a weekend together. That was always great. That group kind of dispersed, and as I was really getting serious about redoing this book, I was a little bereft of not having such a group. So I reached out to some varied people to be my beta readers, my early beta readers, and I chose a bookstore owner because I wanted to get a seller's perspective. And I chose, you know, she'd never been asked before, and she loved doing it, so I encourage everybody to ask their bookstore owners. And then I picked a couple friends, and I picked a couple of writers, and one person I didn't know very well because I admired her fastidiousness. And that feedback was just amazing. And one of them was, I think she's on the call, named Penny, who was my buddy in that class that we took with you. And Penny lives in Seattle, but we became really good buddies during that class, and so she was one of those beta readers also. And then in terms of editors,
on beta readers, what did you ask of them? Did you have a series of questions? Did you want to know certain things, or was it free-floating? Tell us a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did have a list of questions, key questions, and I think in a few cases on certain chapters I might have even had some specific questions, but I did have some key questions to ask them. Frankly, I don't remember what they were, but there was a list, you know, of six or seven things. But I also, you know, encouraged them to give me any feedback that they wanted to. And that was just so tremendously helpful. I mean, it was, I think I had 8 people involved. So when I got them back, it was a little overwhelming because there was a lot of feedback. You know, mostly good, but a lot of suggestions about things that didn't flow right or they were confused by, you know, very good. And so I took all that feedback and then rolled it into the draft that I thought was going to be the final draft for the book, for production. And as I said, there were about 15 more drafts after that. So, you know, it was sort of draft after draft after draft during that last year. And not you know, not everything had to be altered significantly, but plenty had to be changed. And in fact, I had not written anything before the beta readers got it. I had not written anything about my life from 20 to 40, so my first marriage, that whole 20-year period. And when Brooke read the manuscript, she said, well, you can't really get away with not telling us anything about what happened for 20 years. So, but I hadn't, because I didn't want to. My ex was alive. My children are alive. That I didn't want to write about them and expose them. So beta readers were, you know, there's no question that I'll use them for the second book. As far as editors go, I hired a number to help me along the way. And frankly, some of them, when I look back at it, really weren't that great. I mean, they were good technically, I think, but they didn't know the marketplace. They didn't have any idea about, they weren't memoir specialists. You know, they were basic, you know, Chicago-style editors or whatever. And I would encourage people to really, if you are writing memoir, to find editors who really know memoir, because it is a different, it's a different form. And so that's where, you know, Brooke came in. And I think, but, you know, and you have to sort of make peace with the editor, too. It's like, I remember when I hired Brooke, I really just in my own head said, take whatever she says, you know, take whatever she gives you, because she knows 1,000 times more than you do. And I think in the past with editors, I sometimes said, well, I don't really agree with that, you know, or I don't think they really know what they're talking about. Or, and I, at this point I was ready, you know, to just do what she said, basically.
Lovely,
you know,
advice.
I mean,
lovely
just,
advice.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Well, but let's add one more thing to it, and that is you also had a lot of experience by then. And if there was something you really, really, really couldn't deal with or bear, and you spoke of it, I mean, an editor will at least listen and give their reason. So that we can understand it. It's not like you surrender everything to the editor.
No. No, I made that a little too strong probably, but I because I remember pushing back on her and not doing everything she said, but there was sort of a big, it was a big step for me to
surrender.
Basically say, to surrender to the advice of a professional, a real professional, you know, who knows the market and all of that. And some of her advice was clearly, you know, market related, and you know,
we want that, we need that.
Yeah, exactly. So
I mean, if we want anybody to read it, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, which we do.
Yeah, we
surprisingly.
Do. Well, let's talk about publishing before it's time to open it up for you know, for questions and discussion with you, and that is did it feel like to go public, and what was your experience with publishing? I mean, you knew Brooke, and she writes press, so that was connected. But tell us more about the design elements, or what it was like to go public.
Yeah. Well, first, just sort of on the production, the design, and all that. First of all, I was lucky that She Writes Press loved the title, and they came up with this amazing cover And although I had, you know, 10 options for covers sent to me by Julie Metz, who's a just incredible designer, this one was the one that really landed for me. And that ripped tape, actually, interesting, I think Brooke said, I'm pretty sure Brooke said this to me, that was one of the first times there's been a graphically lifted thing off the top, off the cover of a book. So
let's describe it for a minute. So it's a picture, a black and white, essentially, of you and your father. You're about, what, 2 years old or something?
Yeah, maybe three. Yeah.
And it looks like a bent photograph, actually, and then there's a beige piece of tape that looks like tape. It looks like masking tape. It says poetic license, and the edges of the masking tape are curled up. Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
So I was thrilled with the cover. I was glad that they liked my title. The design, the inside design, I loved right away as soon as I got it. I just had no real issues with any of that. The production, you know, figuring out how many copies to print, and that's all really complicated. And I hope they all sell out in the first year. So there's lots of sort of stress along the way, I felt anyway. Pretty stressful as you're moving towards production. But once it came out, what really amazed me was this. I had been so stressed for the 6 months prior to publication. Some of it was tactical, you know, technical production stuff, but some of it was emotional, like what is going to happen and what will my family ultimately say and who might say whatever. And frankly, in my story, are there other women who might come forward with any kind of allegation or anything about my dad? And so there was stress around all of that. As soon as the book got out, all of that just completely went away. It's just like turned off a switch. It was kind of as if, you know, okay, it's out there in the world. It's sort of like sending a kid out in the world at 20, you know, where you hope they'll be all right. You hope they won't get beaten down. You hope you've done okay. And you know, most are able to kind of make it when you do. And I think that's a little bit how I felt about the book. It was kind of like, okay, I can't do anything more about it now. So it's on its own. I mean, I can publicize it and I can promote it and blah, 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 but I can't. It is what it is, and it's got to sort of, you know, make its own way in the world. So I think that was the main sort of surprise for me, and I'm very grateful for that, really.
It's like raising a child, you know. It has a life of its
own. It is. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's I think when people are in the middle of writing it and figuring it out, it's hard to imagine this stage in a way. And this is why it's really good for people to hear about it, so that when they arrive at that stage, then it's like, oh, yeah, Gretchen told us about this possible feeling that I'm having or whatever.
Right.
Whatever
process. I will say, I mean, one thing that I think probably this is true of every author who gets published, but I will say that I really miss writing. You know, I've had to write content to be placed, and I've had to, you know, write little things, but the actual sort of absorbing yourself for half a day or a day or a week or a month, you know, in a story and trying to figure things out on your own and or with a little bit of help. But that solo process I actually really miss. And that is something that I look forward to getting back to. And with publishing a book, there is an awful lot to do in leading up to it, and then there's a lot to do after it's out. So I probably some authors are able to kind of handle both, but I don't seem to be able to yet anyway.
It's just so much. Well, tell us about this New York Times review. Now, I know that one thing that Brooke published a blurb about was the fact that the reviewer, or the style of a New York Times book review, for some at least, I guess if you're not very well known, is to pit two books against each other.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of what that was like. So tell people more, you know, better than
right.
I do.
Well, I worked with BookSparks as my publicity team, and at the beginning of the run, you know, they asked, what are your dream media? And I said, well, you know, Terry Gross and New York Times and stuff. And some of that, I think, comes from my dad's era, really, and you know, he was reviewed a lot in the New York Times, and sometimes badly and sometimes well. And I was around that. But anyway, the New York Times was sort of, you know, a place that I wanted to see if I could get into. And I knew it was tough. It's really, really hard for debut authors. There was some article I read stating how many books the New York Times receives every day, and it was just, I can't remember what the number was, but
hundreds,
it's just like,
hundreds.
I mean, yeah, hundreds and hundreds. And so how they pick, you know, the one for that day or whatever, I have no clue. But in any case, they asked a woman who has one memo out and another one on the way to review my book against, or, you know, it was a comparative comparative review with another first-time memoirist from Australia who's won all kinds of prizes and everything already for other work that she's done. And the reviewer clearly loved her book and really didn't like my book. And, you know, that's kind of fine, but I think the way that she wrote it and, you know, it's like the first sentence and the last sentence were really hard for me to take. And
yeah.
I thought very unfair, and it was sort of unnecessary. It just seemed very mean. So when I was emoting about it to Brooke, she said, oh my God, I can't stand it. You know, she told me that that the New York Times has done that more frequently, and that it is surprising. I mean, women writers have been so generous and kind and compassionate and caring and supportive to me, and women can also be really mean to each other. And
yeah.
But it's sort of it's hard to imagine really wanting to just sort of cut down almost any memoirist, you know, who's for the first time getting their book out. But that's not to say it shouldn't be critiqued on some level, of course. And I can accept that. I was heartened by a writing friend who, after seeing this whole brouhaha, and, you know, sympathizing with me, sent me an article or something that Maureen Corrigan, who does the book reviews for Fresh Air, that she wrote. And she wrote about her rules kind of for reviewing books. And one of them was that she would never do a negative review for a debut author, because the whole point of reviewing a debut author is to find out what audience that writer has. And so, you know, I appreciate that, because it made me feel better. And I think if any of the other reviews had said the same kind of thing, or if any of my Amazon reviews or Goodreads reviews, et cetera, said anything like it, it might be one thing, but they haven't. And so I think the reviewer just didn't like my book, and books are very subjective, you know.
Well,
you like
that's
one
the
and
thing.
You don't like the next.
I was a little surprised, because I know who that memoirist is. Her books are about surviving the Holocaust and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And I would think, and the thing that she was picking on is how, I haven't read it for a couple of weeks, but, you know, the depth of healing and psychology that your book had in it, and it seemed like she was minimizing or questioning, and the other book was such a happy book, and, you know, I'm like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah, right. Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. Okay.
So
well,
anyway, that
for,
was, it was a blow for about a week, but I'm over it now.
Yeah, well, you had a lot of support on Facebook, and
I sure did.
She Writes Press has our own, you know, space where we can all chat about publications and reviews and everything else, and you got a lot of support, and
I felt that.
I felt bad. I was like, no, they can't do that.
Yeah, when I got the note that it was out, I I mean, I just read the first sentence and my stomach dropped. It was kind of
Well, but it's about not taking it. You know what you wrote and why you wrote it and what you needed to write, and whatever this woman's thing was, it was a thing, it seems like, and you're going to go on and do wonderful things. Well, let's get some people to come on the line and ask you questions or talk about whatever. And so those of you on the line, and there's a lot of you, hit *6 and say your name, and then I can call on different people that in case several people call in at once, which can happen very easily on a tele.
Right.
On the phone. So
right.
Hit *6, those of you who have just been published or want to get published someday and, you know, are thinking about this journey and where you are, and see if get a conversation going here.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from people.
Yeah. *6. Hopefully this is working.
Hi, it's Paula.
Thanks, Paula. Yay.
Yeah, sorry, I'm holding back because I always feel like I am the first one on the line.
Well, that was nice of you, but now go ahead, Yay. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, Gretchen, thank you so much. I'm honestly just listening to you. You hit every single point that I am experiencing now as I get back to writing my second memoir. And
Really
appreciate that validation. And I guess if I have one question, it was early in the conversation, there was a mention of layers of time, positioning yourself through layers of time. And I just thought that was fascinating. It made me think of a fulcrum, that you kind of like you bounce back and forth, but you have to find some center point. I don't know if you could elaborate on that. It's really a question of craft.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's probably one of the things I learned about with Linda and Joy and Brooke, and I'm not even sure that I'm going to be very articulate about it, but it is, you know, it's true that in a memoir, particularly one that takes place over a fairly decent length of time, you know, lots of things are happening, and you are different when you're 10 than when you're 40, and if you're talking about when you're 40, that's sort of layered on top of how you talked when you were 10. And so, I mean, Linda Joy can probably help us more than I can on this, really. But I sort of got it in my head, you know, as a visual, that these layers of time and how they have to kind of mesh with each other and make sense to the reader as the reader goes through. And I did something a little bit different than some memoirs do, I think, in the sense that when I used the voice of my child, sort of being the child or the teenager, I did allow myself to do some reflections and stuff that were more in the adult voice. And I think it did work, but I don't think it's completely usual or something. I mean,
the narrator can come in and assist in a deeper understanding. There's still the narrator voice, and that narrator voice can come in. And if you've been mostly in the child and a little bit of the narrator voice comes in, we just assume that this narrator is helping us understand the child.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Need that. Do you want to say more, Linda Joy, about layers of time, or?
Well, I think Paula has heard a little bit about some of this before in class and stuff, but it is really like finding where you are, just like you said, we're finding where you are in the time and what is the voice and understanding of that person. But it isn't a strict thing because we still have narrator guiding the reader through the layers, and that narrator is not the child. The narrator is not even you right now. It's this guiding voice that helps the reader understand all the different layers of time. It's a little bit neutral, but of course in writing, we find language that works for the moment.
Right.
There's no way to you only know what you're finding when you're writing it. You know, there's no way to tell them.
Right.
You have to find it.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Yep. That's helpful. Hopefully that helps,
Paula.
Good for you for sticking with it.
Yeah, I'll
yeah,
be
Paula.
In thank you. Yeah,
hope we can talk about it sometime.
Yeah,
yeah,
I really
bye-bye.
Need the support, so thank you.
Yeah, bye. Anybody else? It's time for another person to come on the line here.
It's Mary Van Buren.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. And I.
How nice to talk to you.
And likewise, Gretchen. I just want to thank you. I can't wait to read the book. I just picked it up today, and just want to thank you for clarifying this crazy process. I feel like I've learned so much from you tonight. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you for the comment, and I look forward to hearing more about what you're working on. Mary and I have been in some workshops together locally, and I'm glad she's getting serious here.
Welcome, Mary. Join us for some other events in the future if you can.
Thank you. Well,
and good luck with your book.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gretchen. This is Jean Wells, and I am currently in the Write Your Memoir in 6 Month class. And
hi, Jean.
Listening to you. Hello, Linda Joy, about the arc and the timeline, kind of the outline,
mm-hmm.
is a struggle.
Yep.
And I really appreciated hearing how you would do it the second time, but how you think that might have helped you the first time.
Right.
I'm looking forward to reading your book and really appreciate all of your comments.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I just think it would have reined me in some, you know. I had a tendency to sort of go off in different tangents or, you know, decide to shape the book this way and then shape it that way. And just because I was sort of striking out in the dark and not getting anywhere, I felt. And so I think, you know, having at least some kind of outline would have been really helpful to me. So I hope that's useful to you.
Yeah, and Jean, you know, we talk about in class about how some people that are a little bit more right brain oriented go, oh, I don't really need that, or oh dear, I'll feel too constricted. But then there's the light holding of just a little bit of a map, you know, and it can help. Let us know what you need around that.
Right.
Can I say thank you?
Hello.
Can I say thank you to Gretchen too? I'm Colleen.
Great.
Hi.
Hi. I'm actually in Sydney. I'm very sorry for the Australian.
No, I love the Australian voice. Good to hear you.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure. I started reading your free sample on Kindle yesterday, and I couldn't stop. But I actually had to stop at the end, and then I still bought it. So I can't wait to get back to the end of the Kindle to read it all. So I got up to about where you were just starting to go through the boxes of the material.
The letters.
That
yeah.
Yeah, and you were talking a little bit about therapy, but I sort of just got to that bit. What I'm interested in, if you could please help me just understand a bit more, because I'm just in a bit. I've been writing for years memoir, but like, you know, for preparation memoir, but I'm now doing a draft. The title is Am I, what is it? it's a parenting memoir. Mm-hmm. Am I a Good Mother is the current title. I'm just wondering, when you say you tried to ground in the 1990s, I'd just like to understand more about how you decided to ground it in the 1990s and work before and back in forward in time.
And, so, Gretchen, we have about 1 minute left, so see if you can.
Okay. I'll be really quick,
together.
And if you want to get in touch through my website, feel free. It was really because that was such a rich decade for me, and it also is when I felt I was kind of in crisis trying to figure out how to sort of be the public face of my father, which I needed to be as he aged,
while at the same time having had this experience with him that was negative, you know. And so after my mom died, I found it really hard to kind of be his proxy, which I was becoming more and more as he got older. So that was really the point of crisis for me. That's really why the 90s was used. I hope that's helpful, at least in short form.
Thank
it
you.
Is. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much
for
joining us.
Yeah. Really.
All right, everybody. Thank you all for being here. Thank you so much, Gretchen. This was a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed it so much.
Well, thank you, Linda Joy, for everything you're doing, and likewise to everybody who made the effort to get on the call. I appreciate it. And, you know,
yeah,
please be in touch.
I'm going to unmute everybody so we can all yell goodbye to you.
Okay.
Goodbye, and thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye, Gretchen.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
Good luck with your writing.
Bye.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Stay safe. Bye-bye.
You too.